Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Advancing the Rheumatoid Arthritis Armamentarium with Emerging Therapies. This CME activity is based in part on the slides and lectures presented by the faculty at the ACR Post-Conference Industry-Supported Symposium, Aggressively Pursuing Remission in Rheumatoid Arthritis, Where Will Emerging Therapies Fit into the Treatment Armamentarium, which was held on November 9, 2011, at the McCormick Place Convention Center in Chicago, Illinois. Copyright by the North American Center for Continuing Medical Education, all rights reserved. No part of this accredited continuing medical education activity may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, electronic or mechanical, without first obtaining permission from the North American Center for Continuing Medical Education. This activity is certified by the North American Center for Continuing Medical Education and presented by Clifton O. Bingham III, M.D., Daniel Al-Taha, M.D., Paul Emery, M.D., and Joseph S. Smolin, M.D. Dr. Al-Taha is an associate professor, Division of Rheumatology, Medical University of Vienna, Vienna, Austria. Dr. Al-Taha has made the following disclosures: grant and/or research support from Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Shearing Plough, UCB, and F. Hoffman LaRoche, consultant for Pfizer, Merck Sharp & Dohme, F. Hoffman LaRoche, UCB, and Abbott Laboratories. Dr. Bingham is an assistant professor of medicine, Division of Rheumatology, Department of Medicine, Johns Hopkins University, Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Bingham has made the following disclosures: grant and/or research support from Abbott Laboratories, Amgen, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Genentech, F. Hoffman LaRoche, and Wyeth, consultant for Amgen, Centocor Ortho Biotech, Genentech, Millennium Pharmaceuticals, Novartis Pharmaceuticals, F. Hoffman LaRoche, UCB, and Pfizer, independent contractor, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Genentech, F. Hoffman LaRoche, and UCB. Dr. Emery is an Arthritis Research UK Professor of Rheumatology, Head of Section, Musculoskeletal Disease, Leeds Institute of Molecular Medicine, University of Leeds, President, European League Against Rheumatism, Leeds, United Kingdom. Dr. Emery has made the following disclosures: scientific advisor for Merck Sharp & Dohme, Pfizer, Abbott Laboratories, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and F. Hoffman LaRoche. Dr. Smolin is a professor of internal medicine and chairman of the Department of Rheumatology, Vienna General Hospital, Medical University of Vienna, Vienna, Austria. Dr. Smolin has made the following disclosures: grant and/or research support from Abbott Laboratories, F. Hoffman LaRoche, UCB, Pfizer, Merck & Company, and Bristol-Myers Squibb, scientific advisor for Amgen, Abbott Laboratories, MedImmune, Roche, UCB, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Pfizer, Merck & Company, and Centocor Ortho Biotech. The purpose of this activity is to provide rheumatologists and related healthcare professionals with an update on the new classification and remission criteria, issues surrounding discontinuation of therapy, and how emerging treatment options impact the aggressive pursuit of remission for patients with rheumatoid arthritis. This activity is supported by MedImmune. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Clifton Bingham. I'm an associate professor in the Division of Rheumatology at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'll be your moderator for today's discussion. I'm joined by three of my colleagues today: Dr. Daniel Al-Taha, an associate professor in the Division of Rheumatology at the University of Vienna in Austria, and Dr. Paul Emery, professor of rheumatology at Leeds University in the UK, and Dr. Joseph Smolin, professor of medicine and chairman of the Department of Rheumatology at the Medical University of Vienna in Austria. Our goals for today's discussion include outlining changes to RA disease classification and remission criteria to develop appropriate therapeutic strategies for the aggressive pursuit of remission and management of comorbidities, to interpret emerging data on the controllable factors that impact patients remaining on therapy, to describe the current data regarding safety issues associated with biological therapies, such as the risk of serious infection and side effects, to compare and contrast the safety, efficacy, and clinical profiles of newer and emerging options for RA management, to overcome hesitation to switch biological therapy in patients receiving an inadequate response. Thank you again for joining us today. Rheumatoid arthritis is the most common form of autoimmune inflammatory arthritis, affecting from 0.5% to 1% of most populations. The most obvious symptoms associated with RA are joint pain, swelling, and stiffness, but patients are considerably affected by a number of other symptoms, including fatigue. The resulting joint inflammation results in a loss of physical function, work productivity, and multiple aspects of health-related quality of life. It's the failure to manage the inflammatory aspects of the disease that leads to permanent and irreversible joint damage that can be detected even within a few months of the first symptoms of disease. In addition to the effects on joints, the ongoing inflammation of RA is associated with a number of comorbid conditions, including accelerated cardiovascular disease and increased risk of certain malignancies and infection. In the last decade, we've been able to significantly change the outcome for many patients with RA through earlier disease recognition, earlier initiation of disease-modifying therapy, and more aggressive treatment strategies, including targeted biological agents. Through today's session, and with our esteemed international panel, we will address many of the recent developments in RA diagnosis and treatment. I'd like to address my first question to Dr. Daniel Alataha. Daniel, how does the early diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis impact what we do for our patients?
Well, I think one part of the answer to this question is very intuitive, and is the fact that with every day of arthritis, some damage occurs in RA. We know that, and therefore, one very simple answer to it is just saving time for the joint, for preventing joint damage, erosions of the bone, and cartilage loss. That's one aspect, and as I said, it's intuitive, and you already addressed it partly in your introduction. The other part is that there is still the concept out there that if we treat aggressively in the very early phase of the disease, we might be able to change the future course of the disease, which is an additional aspect of why early treatment may be important in rheumatoid arthritis.
We have new classification criteria for rheumatoid arthritis, and you were part of the effort to work on those classification criteria. Can you tell us a little bit about why those classification criteria were derived?
Well, first of all, I think that we talk about classification criteria, and I think a very important point to make here in the beginning is that classification is not meant to be used for clinical purposes to make a diagnosis, which is still what I think the rheumatologist is here for. But classification certainly can help us make a diagnosis, can inform our decision-making process or diagnostic process, as it was the case with the old criteria. The deficiencies of those old criteria were mainly that they were developed in patient populations that had an average disease duration of 8 or 9 years. And this has been criticized from the beginning, but now as we recognize that earlier therapy becomes important, they were becoming a true deficiency. They were including, as part of a classification, they were including outcomes such as erosions. At that time, that might have been reasonable to say an erosion is really a diagnostic element for rheumatoid arthritis, but these days erosions or erosiveness is something that we want to prevent, actually. We don't want to see this actually occur. So other elements like rheumatoid nodules were very infrequently seen. And the effort was there to improve these criteria, to change them, modify them in a way that they would also be able to classify patients with rheumatoid arthritis at an earlier stage.
Can you review for us some of the elements that have gone into the classification criteria?
Certainly. I mean, the classification criteria are based, very simple scoring system covering four different domains that are important for making a classification. That's obviously the joints, the joint activity. It weighs in the number of joints. It gives more credit to small joints, which are more typical for rheumatoid arthritis. So that's one category. Another category is serology, so rheumatoid factor, and antibodies against citrullinated peptides, so-called ACPAs. The third one is duration, which has a six-week cut point, giving you additional credit if you have longer duration. And the final one is, and that's also new compared to the old criteria, is acute phase reactance, which is, when you ask rheumatologists, a very important element of making a diagnostic decision. It hasn't been part of the old criteria. Now you can, if you have elevated acute phase reactance, also get an additional credit for towards classification of rheumatoid arthritis.
So you've told us that these are not intended to be diagnostic criteria, but of course they will in some ways be used in that way. Do you think that that necessarily is a bad thing in terms of changing what we think of as rheumatoid arthritis?
I don't think it's a bad thing as long as we understand the different concepts. I think they can be very useful for both purposes, classification for studies, where we're looking for homogeneous populations to study, and for informing a diagnosis. Having said that, it is not surprising, and it will not be surprising if the classification criteria and the result of the criteria don't match clinical diagnosis. And if you are trying to look at how these classification criteria work and you use a gold standard of a physician's diagnosis, they are always going to be different. And that's the difference you detect there is not necessarily telling you that the classification criteria are bad. It tells you that there is something that's simply different between classification and diagnosis. Some concept that rheumatologists, their experience, the discussion with the patient, regional differences and so forth that go into family history, that go into the diagnostic process, but cannot be formalized in classification criteria.
But in the context of this discussion, Daniel, if I may briefly interrupt, Bing, it's also important to consider that there are indirect exclusion criteria, because the preamble to the criteria says to the individual items says that the joint swelling, the arthritis, should not be due to another diagnosis. So we have already a diagnostic process sort of before we apply the criteria, don't we?
That's correct, Joseph, and that's obviously very important when really formally using the classification criteria, and it's mainly gone into the into this set of criteria, this exclusion criteria, to prevent patients with gout, for example, to be possibly classified. Where gout is for most rheumatologists a very easy diagnosis to recognize, and it should probably not be attempted to be classified as rheumatoid arthritis.
Dr. Emery.
Well, I think yesterday we had an example of how people are finding it a little hard to get to grips with the new criteria, because there was a study presented of very early arthritis which had only 30% fulfilled the old criteria, but 90% fulfilled the new criteria. And one of the questions was how many of these patients developed rheumatoid arthritis. Now, of course, because the patients were treated early, many of them didn't develop the old criteria. And so people are confusing in this way the classification criteria, which allows us to have homogeneous populations for treatment, with a diagnostic criteria. And I think it's going to take a little while for people to get used to this. I must say that the new criteria have changed beyond all expectations, the ability to treat patients early and call them a disease. And I think they are going to be used diagnostically, but they will have an enormous benefit for patients because it will allow registration for drugs in this early population.
And for me, I think one of the benefits actually changes the concept of the disease that needs to be treated aggressively. And that's actually a message, I think, that needs to be carried out to the primary care providers so that they begin to recognize that this is a disease that needs to be diagnosed early so that we can begin with early intervention.
And I think in this context, it's very important to, and I think partly you were saying this, that to have a referral criteria for the primary care physician. We don't want the primary care physician, we don't even want the rheumatologist to use the classification criteria for diagnosis, but we don't want the primary care physician to use these criteria. I mean, if they're interested, they can apply it to their patients. But I think what primary care physicians are challenged with, you know, they have to be masters on all different kinds of fields, not as ourselves here who are really on one specialty. So they need to know a few important things. A few important elements, and I think, Paul, you published earlier, a couple of years ago, referral guidance for primary care physician that included morning stiffness and a certain number of swollen joints and a positive squeeze test. Simple tests that you can, you know, provide the primary care physician with to get a quick referral to a rheumatologist.
So these criteria, no doubt, will allow us to classify disease earlier, especially in the context of clinical trials and also initiating therapy. There's also been another development in the last year that's been extremely important, and many of you were also involved in this effort, to develop new criteria for remission of rheumatoid arthritis, which I think speaks tremendously to the impact that we're now having on this disease. Can I ask you, Daniel, to tell us a little bit about those remission criteria? Why we needed them and what went into that process. And any of you can chime in with additional information for us.
Well, I think Joseph will have lots of additional information as he was leading that project, but I'm happy to answer the question. So I think a little bit in contrast to the classification criteria, where we had one clear set of criteria which we found not to work anymore, for the remission we had lots of different criteria. The old ARA criteria, DAS criteria, DAS-28 criteria, SDAS criteria, all criteria based on different ways to measure disease activity, putting the cut point for remission somewhere. So what we were facing was that if people like us were talking to each other about patients, how many patients you have in remission, we would get strange numbers and different numbers whoever you talk to, and that was essentially based on, you know, what definition you use to call something remission. If you use a stringent definition, you get fewer patients. If you use a loose definition, you get more patients in remission. So I think the main purpose of the new criteria, which are also a collaborative project of the two organizations and therefore will hopefully have an impact, was to homogenize the definition of remission. And I think that has worked very well, and will future studies will show us if these criteria will truly be implemented. And I think so.
Joseph, would you like to come in on the criteria?
I think Daniel has mentioned the important points as the background to the criteria. Overall, there is two types of criteria, Boolean type criteria, or several characteristics of the disease, swollen joint count, tender joint count, patient global and CRP should be one or less. And there is index-based criteria using the simplified disease activity index with the cut point that Daniel established many years ago as the cut point for remission of 3.3. And then there is also for clinical practice in the same publication a suggestion to currently, as long as we have nothing better for clinical practice, employ these criteria potentially without CRP. So have three items for the Boolean criteria and the clinical disease activity index with a cut point of 2.8.
Paul, do you think that these remission criteria will be implemented in clinical practice? Is this a realistic goal that you feel that we can achieve for our patients?
Oh, undoubtedly. I think we're all seeking to get a level of remission which really allows patients to do something different. In other words, stay completely well, maintain their quality of life, not get structural damage, and be sure that in 5 years' time they're going to be the same as they are now. We need to prove these definitions in clinical practice because they were derived from clinical trials. But we all are very keen to have remission at a much lower level. We've known for some time that the existing remission criteria, apart from the very stringent ARA ones, which were very difficult to fulfill, meant that it was really low disease activity and that these patients were doing better, but not probably as well as they should have been. And, you know, the old adage is good to be better, but it's better to be good, is very true. With remission, you really want qualitatively different state.
But there's something that you have indirectly already mentioned, Bing, and that is that 15 years ago, 20 years ago, did we speak about remission? So times have changed. And when we look in our clinic, we have about 20% of the patients fulfilling the stringent remission criteria. That is something remarkable for people who grew up like Paul and myself with gold injections and deep penicillamine that later turned out not to be working, and so on and so forth. And so I think that this is a remarkable situation, and with more and more new therapies, we will be able to drive this proportion of patients higher and higher, and that is very rewarding, especially for our patients, but also for us as physicians, because we can witness this development and we can attain the goal.
Absolutely. That's a nice transition into my next question. Paul, there's been a lot of work, obviously, from EULAR and also from the American College of Rheumatology over the last couple of years, really to move forward with guidelines to help us in terms of treatment. And part of that, you know, relates to the development of this remission criteria as well. Can you talk to us a little bit about where we are in terms of guidelines of treatment in general terms and some things that could help people in terms of utilizing these guidelines in clinical practice?
Yes, I think the status of early intervention at one level is very clear. You start immediately that you make a diagnosis of a persistent arthritis, and that's now nearly everywhere. All of those patients will have a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis with a new criteria. They will start undoubtedly on a DMARD, which would be almost certainly methotrexate. There is some debate about whether there should be triple therapy. Some people believe it should. Our own review at EULAR concluded that actually the major benefit came from using full dose of methotrexate with steroid, and the additional benefit, although you do get a small increment in some poor responders, the additional benefit of extra therapy is not sufficient to get good responses. So the standard therapy would be a steroid bridging therapy with high-dose methotrexate, and unless you reach some fairly stringent endpoints at 3 or 6 months, and this is incorporating the concept of treating to target, which is targeting low disease activity ideally by 3 months, remission ideally by 6 months, and unless you reach those targets, then you have an escalation of therapy, and these days that means biologic therapy. So that's the general principle. But having said that, there's a lot of us who would prefer to really use the best drugs first. And this is a considerable debate. It's not recommended at the moment. But if using a remission induction approach with perhaps the biologic therapies being used in selected patients with poor prognosis to try and reset the disease, and that the jury is out really on that, on whether that's an approach which will be either cost-effective or produce better long-term outcomes. And there are some very intriguing data relating to that. But as I said, that can't be recommended as standard therapy just yet.
There were several presentations actually at the ACR meeting this year regarding this concept of biologic induction and then actually beginning to withdraw or taper therapy afterwards. Joseph, do you want any comments to those studies?
Well, the situation is, again, on the one hand surprising, on the other hand rewarding, and on the third side, confirmatory. We had data from Japan and from Leeds that indicated that when you started biological therapy earlier, you could withdraw therapy without risking flares in most of the patients, but rather keeping remission or at least low disease activity in the majority of the patients. Whereas when you started biologic therapy late in the course of the disease, that was a study, first author was Salem, then withdrawing led to flares. And here at this very meeting, with several presentations that suggest that indeed this is what is the case.
when you start early on with the biologic therapy, attain low disease activity by 6 months, you can withdraw biologic therapy and the majority of the patients remain in the good state. And structural progression is minimal. Everything on methotrexate, background methotrexate, not background, it's also de novo starting of methotrexate, but continuing with methotrexate. In contrast, when you have established RA patients that have background methotrexate therapy, have moderate disease activity, get to a state of low disease activity and you withdraw then, that is something that's afflicted with flares in the majority of the patients. And restart of structural damage. So, yeah, we all in clinical practice, you, Paul, Daniel, I myself, we used to play around with intervals, with doses in patients who have attained a good state. Well, we've never done that with the background of evidence, which now appears to show up. However, Paul mentioned the early start. The plasticity of the immunoinflammatory system appears to be different in the early days of the disease, in the early weeks, months, than it is in established disease. And that is something that we have to explore. As Paul said, we cannot recommend currently to start with very intensive therapy, biological agents, knowing that we have a very good drug like methotrexate that can convey a very good result in a decent proportion of patients. However, we have to explore this further, and I would not be surprised if in 2 or 3 years we have that information from several studies for several biological agents, whether it is really possible to restat the immune, the inflammatory system, and maybe even dream of cure early on. But that's something I shouldn't even take into my mouth because that is really only a dream.
I have to say as well, I mean, I think that this meeting has been really, the ACR meeting this year and even EULAR and the recent publications really is sort of a turning point for us in showing what we can do with patients and really bringing to the fore this concept that our window of opportunity may actually be something that's real and not
Absolutely.
Something that we just have
Absolutely.
Talked about for the last 5 to 10 years.
Absolutely.
So one of the pieces that's implicit in the guidelines is following people's response over time and doing something if people are not responding adequately. But one of the other challenges that takes place is people losing response to therapy over time. Paul, can you comment a little bit about how people might lose response and what that looks like and what the mechanisms behind that may represent?
Yes, and particularly as we're talking mainly now about biologic therapy, but biologic therapy unfortunately still has a very high dropout. You have mentioned earlier use when we started many years ago, the two therapies we had, penicillin and gold, the retention rate on therapy was 10% at 3 to 5 years. Suddenly we had methotrexate, which was actually much better tolerated, although still with many side effects. Then biologics were introduced, and the biologics appeared to have a great advantage in tolerability, but we were all a little surprised when the longer-term data came out and found that at 5 years, 50% have stopped, and some nearly 50% at 3 years. Some of that is due to the fact that the biologics are given at a time when there's less incremental benefit from those drugs. They're given with patients with long morbidities and very abnormal systemic disease. But there's still a very high dropout from conventionally used biologics. And it occurs, it's quite interesting because when it occurs, differs according to the duration of disease, differs according to the years of treatment. So initially it's in efficacy, later it's toxicity. But there are different types of efficacy. There's primary non-response, there's secondary non-response. Secondary non-response is when you respond and then gradually lose the response. And the mechanisms for these are quite different. And what happens when you switch drugs is also rather different, depending on how you came to lose the response in the first place. So we're beginning to understand these. And there are other reasons as well that, you know, that actually patients, fortunately now, are beginning to stop therapy because they're so well. Now, this is an issue. If stopping therapy when you are very well leads to flares which you then can't control. If stopping therapy is completely satisfactory because you've actually reset the immune system, that's different. But many patients take it into their own hands. I'm feeling well, I don't need to take the drug. We're beginning to learn whether these patients are taking a risk or not. But there are many reasons. It's a fascinating subject, and it's one that hasn't had the attention it might have had because it appeared that compliance was very good with these drugs. But at the end of the day, you're looking at 5 years, half of them not taking what they set out on.
Some of the qualitative work that we've recently done with Sarah Hewlett-led for Omerect has really shown that patients do manipulate their medications significantly, even their biologics. And they don't necessarily even tell us what they're doing. So I think part of our challenge as physicians moving forward is actually to acknowledge that this is happening and try to capture that information so that we can sort of work together to come up with an optimal treatment strategy.
Well, I grew up in an era when we were putting barbiturates in drugs to trace to see whether they were taking or not as a marker. But, of course, it was very different then because the drugs were unpleasant, patients felt unwell, and the benefit wasn't so clear-cut. I think when we started with biologics, patients were so grateful to get a therapy that worked that their compliance, I think, was very good. Now they know there are many options. They don't feel compelled to stay on what they're first given.
Daniel, can you address from any of the databases that you're so familiar with how well we're really doing in terms of reaching these endpoints and getting people down? Joseph commented a little bit, but you have sort of a very good knowledge across the range of databases. And how realistic are we talking here?
Well, mostly my answer will probably relate to our own clinical data that we are documenting in a database. And the fact is that we very rarely stop therapy, which is, I think, an aspiration for the future that we get patients even in better remission. Because we know also from the observational studies, observational withdrawal studies, that those patients who get the flares, despite being in remission or having been in remission, are those who have been in, you know, just remission, but not completely gone with the disease activity. And that the subset of patients that doesn't flare is the one that's really been longest and deepest in remission. And I think we might be able to see those patients more. Currently, we rarely stop therapy. Occasionally, we do, as Joseph mentioned, without truly databases in terms of clinical trials. We do tell patients to increase the intervals of some of the drugs to test. And I think to test whether this still works and whether they are able to maintain a good state. And I just want to emphasize again the point you were making about adherence, and I think it's a very important point. And maybe some of our non-responders, and we have these notorious non-responders who cycle through all our therapies, and if we do treat to target relatively quickly cycle through all the therapies, that we should really also find ways to increase adherence. We need to understand it first. I'm aware of literature in other specialties that shows that there is really poor and unexpectedly poor, and to the surprise of the physicians, poor adherence to drugs. And I think it's not going to be different, although I don't know particular data in rheumatology. But we need to understand the problem and also deal with this kind of problem.
That may be one of the potential advantages to an infusible type of medication. You know that the patient at least is getting the medication and not able to sort of ad lib use it or not use it. But as we look at our treatment armamentarium, we have seen the advent of the TNF antagonists now with 5 of those on the market. We have co-stimulatory blockade. We have B-cell inhibitors. We have inhibitors of interleukin-6 and arguably interleukin-1, though not with a lot of success in RA. It's given us a huge number of tools at our disposal. And we've sort of learned, I think, over the last decade how to begin the process of utilizing these agents in practice. The challenges come, again, if you don't respond to the first agent. Where do you go next? How do you make that decision? How do you deal with switching within a class or moving on to another class of agents? And I know I'm always asked this question, and I don't have a good answer for it, but I'd be interested in your different opinions in that sort of process. How do you make that decision? Is there any science behind where you go, or is it something that remains empiric? And Paul, can I ask you to start with that?
Well, it's obviously one of the most difficult questions in medicine at the moment, particularly in rheumatology. If you're looking at reasons to select one cytokine versus another, you should really be evidence-based. And if you stick to the evidence, it's very hard to actually distinguish. But anecdotally, there are things that we now understand, which, and perhaps the easiest reason for a logical approach to choosing one over another is the side effect profile. And it's the exclusions which first make things most clear. And in our own case, we've developed, we have an organization called NICE, which is the National Institute for Clinical Health and Excellence, and they have a order of treatments. But within that, we've negotiated and actually changed the algorithm according to subsets of disease, which probably not worth going into at the moment, but it does, the order in which we use the drugs changes if the phenotype of the disease is different. And I think the phenotype is the easiest thing because a clinician can pick that up and actually can apply that to their own practice. There's a huge amount of effort that's gone into actually identifying the genetic and the gene expression markers that might help, but they haven't been clinically predictive. One of the issues you have is that these are very successful drugs, and the biggest factor is when you use them. If you use them very early, you have very high response rates, and the lack of response is seen in a very small population, which means the predictive power of any biomarker to predict the outcome is very small. So they're a product of their own success in a way. But we are learning. It's a complex area, and it's one that we'd love to have a neat biomarker that would predict a response to a particular cytokine inhibitor or a particular cellular modulator. But at the moment, there isn't a clinically relevant one, unfortunately.
As we look ahead, and from the EULAR meeting this year, from the ACR meeting this year, I'm struck at the number of agents that continue to be developed for our field, and especially for rheumatoid arthritis, some familiar mechanisms, some new mechanisms. Joseph, could I ask you to review sort of what you think are the hot molecules, or at least the hot targets in this sea of cytokines and targets that are out there?
Again, I have to repeat, we live in fascinating times, and it's very rewarding to be a rheumatologist these days and over the last decade. We have a number of agents. As you said, numerous clinical trials were presented at these two global conferences this year. Well, some of them are directed against known targets. Interestingly enough, there is good clinical phase 2 data on a new human antibody against the interleukin-6 receptor. For years, we have been wondering why people target the interleukin-6 receptor and not the ligand. Now we have three compounds that are in clinical trials, and we've seen data over the last 12 months, including in this very meeting, that suggest that targeting IL-6 conveys the very same clinical efficacy. We don't have structural data like for tocilizumab. So there is something moving on that end. We have five TNF inhibitors. We may end up having five different molecules that target the interleukin-6 pathway in the near future. But there is also other molecules that are targeted by biological and non-biological therapies. So one of them, for example, is interleukin-17, and the phase 2 trials suggest that there is clinical efficacy, and I assume that this will go into phase 3 trials very soon. Another one, and that was a late-breaking abstract presented yesterday by Professor Burmester from Berlin, targets GM-CSF, granulocyte monocyte colony-stimulating factor, is an important molecule for macrophages, for dendritic cells, for neutrophils, and it is upregulated, it is high in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. And again, it appears as if a monoclonal antibody, mavrilumab, directed against GM-CSF, has clinical efficacy. We have seen all this was in phase 2, so we still need confirmation of phase 3 trials. But we've also seen here a number of phase 3 trials on a JAK1-3 inhibitor, tofacitinib. It works to a similar extent with a similar adverse event profile, more or less, as the biological agent. It works to a similar extent as these other biologics that we, as this biologic, because it's not a biologic, it's an oral small molecule, in terms of clinical efficacy. And here at the ACR meeting, Dr. van der Heide from the Netherlands also showed for the first time that this compound also interferes with structural damage progression. So we have plenty of molecules out there, and I would like to come back to your previous question on where we are moving to, where we are getting to, what is our aspirational goal. If with each drug, very conservative estimate, we get 5% of patients into remission, and these are not the ones and only ones that can respond, so that it's added 5% of remitters, then with 8 or 9 available biologics currently, and with 5 or 6 or 10 more compounds in the near future, maybe in 10 years we have every patient in remission. So that would be, again, another dream. But I think that we're moving toward that goal. We want to employ the treat-to-target algorithm, and when we have 10 drugs, we can for 5 years swap therapies in a patient who is not responding to any of them when we do it every 6 months. And when we have 20 compounds, we can do that for 10 years and try to see what's happening. Ideally, as was discussed by Paul before, we would love to have biomarkers or other markers that indicate to us which compound will work in whom. But that's something that we haven't been successful with, even though we have attempted, not we as a center, but many centers in the world, we as rheumatologists, we as researchers, have attempted to resolve that, to find this. We haven't been successful. Times will go, times will come, and maybe we find something, and then we're there. We can pinpoint by a specific profile to the patient that will respond to a GM-CSF inhibitor, the patient that will respond best to a TNF inhibitor, this patient that will respond best to a JAK1-3 inhibitor, and similar.
Very nice summing up, Joseph. I'd like to ask if, Daniel, you have any final thoughts about our discussion today in terms of the future or where we're headed or what our challenges are. And the same to you, Paul, if you have any sort of concluding thoughts for our audience.
I think Joseph mentioned it a couple of times. It's exciting times. And for us as physicians, because we have diseases that we can now treat, we have to think about how we treat them because we have options. We are learning about not only new drugs, but at the same time on the same level of importance also about the strategies, how to use the drugs, how to follow the patients. And the combination of both, I think, together with the new drugs in the pipeline for the next couple of years, will bring us into positions where we will be more and more thinking about what to do with these patients in remission. And I look forward to that time.
And Paul?
Well, it's really to expand on that, just to say that we have the fortunate position that we have now a whole series of drugs with different modes of action. We have a lot of data acquired from clinical trials. What we don't have is the best application, and it's clear to most of us in this field that we can use the existing drugs much better, and the availability of these new ones give us another part to our armamentarium. So I think what we're going to see in the next few years is actually much better use of these drugs to target what we all want, which is actually to minimize the impact of disease.
Excellent. I think that those are all very nice concluding remarks from the panel. I'd like to thank my esteemed colleagues today for their participation in our discussion. We hope that you found this discussion useful concerning really the up-to-date management of rheumatoid arthritis. Our goals were to increase your awareness of the importance of early disease recognition and diagnosis, the initiation of treatment, and aggressively targeting remission as a goal of therapy. I'd like to thank you very much for your attention today. And to receive credit for the CME activity, please complete the post-test and evaluation.
So maybe one remark, Bing, and that is, it's interesting that the response rates to all the currently available biological agents are relatively similar, and that also the structural data over a year or two are relatively similar. Now we can go to the other thing. Well, it is too early to distinguish which of the compounds may be better or worse. Overall, with a drug like tofacitinib or many the new biological agent, it appears as if the response rates, as we discussed before, were relatively similar to what we saw in other phase 2 for the new biologics or phase 3 trials for tofacitinib. And the adverse events profiles are, at the present time, not really too much distinguishable. There is sometimes more adverse events, sometimes less adverse events. Overall, the safety appears in the phase 2 trial satisfactorily, and generally, the anti-IL-6 monoclonal antibodies have a similar safety profile as we know from tocilizumab. Tofacitinib has a similar safety profile as we know from other biological agents. The agencies will have to review the data. We will have to have more long-term, especially safety data. The efficacy seems to be clear, at least for the ones with the phase 3 trials. The efficacy will have to be established for the ones that have been good, efficacious in phase 2. Overall, we will need more and more safety data to convince us, along the lines that Paul had said before, to convince us which drug in which patients for which reasons to use.
I agree that it is somewhat comforting that when we look across these studies that we do see good responses. I think it does speak to this something about the disease, and we're not seeing things that are not coming in, generally with good responses. I guess the one question that I would have for you, though, and anyone can chime in on this, is the maybe somewhat surprising data concerning B-cell inhibition in rheumatoid arthritis. When we looked with rituximab, when we looked with other molecules that targeted CD20, we saw very similar responses. But when we move into agents that target B-cell-directed cytokines, the results have been a little bit less than encouraging in terms of rheumatoid arthritis. Is there any thought from anyone in terms of why this might be the case?
I might suggest that it's not B-cell cytokines that are relevant, but the B-cells doing something else, which may be antigen presentation. And the data strongly suggests you actually need to deplete the B-cell rather than just modulate it for rheumatoid.
Or reduce them, because the agents that target BLyS and BAFF, they reduce the number of B cells, but they don't deplete the B cells.
And don't work very well in rheumatoid
arthritis. And don't do very well in rheumatoid, yeah.
So I think that's been the one class of agents, if you will, where we have seen some differences. But I think, as Paul, you point out, it probably is telling something about the biology of RA and the real role of the B cell in helping to determine response.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Advancing the Rheumatoid Arthritis Armamentarium with Emerging Therapies. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.